Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 1, delivered on August 19, 2013. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Welcome to Finance. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2. I am Professor Kring. You can call me Professor C. Don't call me by my first name or I'll eat your ass. Some of you already know me. If you don't, God help you. If you do, please don't run out screaming. Again, this is Finance. I'm a financial economist and I'm also a writer. And I run my own business. I'm a professional photographer as well. Now, I caution you in this class that you can't just sit down and just take it easy and watch a TV set, because I'll walk right up to you and I will talk to you. And I expect you to be responsive. Sometimes I am very loud and aggressive. When I ask you a question, I want you to answer me with a responsive kind of answer. Sometimes I yell. I've even been known to fart. And sometimes I use a bad word. I was in the army, I killed people, sue me. You know, so you will find that this is a dynamic class. I mix theory along with practice. I was a consultant for many years. I bring to bear a lot of what I found out about business and finance to these classes. Now, is there some reason this projector sucks? Syllabus for this course is online, and it's in the ReggieNet. I strongly recommend that you go to that ReggieNet site for this course early and often, because sometimes I'll put up a quiz I won't even mention, or an assignment. I won't mention it in class, and there it is for you. You do it, and you get the points for it. If you don't, well, then you're coming to me and asking for an extension, and I'm saying, bite me. So, well, I don't say that. I'm supposed to be nice and all that kind of stuff. But I was going to show you the syllabus here. My office is down in 120. It's nice and big in there. It's comfortable. You can come in, sit down, visit, talk about the class, get some help with your work. There's also finance tutoring available. I don't know the hours. I'll post those on the ReggieNet site when I find out the hours for the tutors. But you're obviously, I'm your first resource because I know everything. Why isn't this showing? It's just like it's beginning to annoy me here. Projector on. Projector mute. What do I have to do? Jump up there and hang from it to bring it down? That's cool. That really helps a lot of people. Really? You know what? Can you guys kind of like form a pyramid and get up there and just kind of... Okay. Let me go through this. I did want to show you a couple of things. First things first, I podcast all of my lectures, and they are available on my own private website, isu-prof.com. They are up about, I try to publish them within 24 hours of a lecture, so that you can go in and listen to the lecture. You can also find these lectures on iTunes. The album is called the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, so they are available there as well. I I don't get it. But, well, let me work on this. Give me a split second here. I think I know what's wrong with this. But you can listen to the lectures. That doesn't mean you don't come to class, because if you're not in class, I'm wondering where you are. Are you eating right? Are you getting your sleep? Are you having sex? Okay, I want to make sure that you are in this classroom and responsive to me. And speaking of being in the classroom and being engaged, we have Junior Experience Day on Friday, the 23rd. If you aren't there, I will find you in your house or hovel or whatever it is you live in. I want you to go, because that is a great place to start your junior experience, because this is when you're going to start looking for internships, and I surely hope that you are going to get one, but you're going to find that it's going to be really tough, and use every advantage you can. I'm looking at this thing, trying to figure out what it is that I have to do to make it work. Screen controls, screen down. Select a source, PC. Projector is on.
It's on.
Do I have to swing a dead cat over it? Or... Okay, they changed the technological thing here, and now I can't figure out. PC. DVD. Aux. Projector. System. I give up. Okay, here are the rules of the class. You're going to have two exams and a final. You're going to have quizzes and homework assignments. Like I said, you're going to see all of this in the syllabus. Here's your book for the class. Don't chintz and not buy the book. There's a lot in this book that you can learn, but I teach you some the book, what is in the book, but I also fill in a lot of detail. So the lectures are somewhat, to some extent, separate from what the book is doing, at least in the sense that I fill in a lot of details and I go into subjects a little more in depth. Some things I just don't even talk about. If I don't mention it, but it's in the book, you're not responsible for it. There are things in the book that I'm just not interested in. Sometimes the book and I will disagree on a subject. If the book and I disagree, who's right? Oh, God, you're good. You're good. Yeah, I'm right. And you'll see that right away today. There's one point the book makes that is just nonsense, but there you are. Anyway, let me get into some other things here in this very quickly. Your quizzes and homework assignments count 30% of your grade. Your exams are 40%, and your final is 30%. So that means that a lot of this class is loaded toward the back end of the course. So everything builds up in this course to where you are ready to ace the exams and the second exam and the final exam. Let me give you a couple of other things here. Now, as far as taking online quizzes and doing online assignments, you have to use Respondus Lockdown. It's a browser. The download link is right here in the syllabus. You'll find it's the Respondus Lockdown browser. If you've never used it before, means that you can't get out of the browser to go and find answers on Wikipedia or something like that. It also means you can't do screen captures. So it's a way that we can use to help ensure the integrity of online assessments, whatever that means. Another thing is the technologies are getting quite good at recording, and you have to keep your cell phones off in class, laptops, iPads, all those kinds of things. These are copyrighted lectures, as you'll see on all of them, they're copyrighted. And that Google Glass that's coming along, don't be a Google Glass hole. Leave those things off, really. I mean, back about around the year 2000, those Bluetooths were being worn by idiots, and now people are walking around with that Google Glass stuff. Don't do that, and don't wear them in class, or I will take them and I will make some really bad things that then go up on Facebook about you. Calculator. You're going to need a calculator for this class. No, you can't use your cell phone calculator. You've got to keep your cell phone off in this class. The basic calculator that's sort of like the old simple workhorse is a BA2. I would recommend against it. I will teach you based on the TI-8384. But this is, it'll work, but you're going to have to figure out how to use it yourself. The book actually gives instructions for financial calculations based on the BA2. So it's a cheap calculator. After the course is over, you can spike it on the sidewalk, that kind of stuff. But it's not the one that would be strong enough to do some of the work. Well, it could do it, but it will be easier if you use this one, the TI-8384 Plus. It has really nice finance functions on it. Matter of fact, most professionals I know in finance use this because it's just got such easy routines for getting things like mortgage payments, calculating bond yields, and all that kind of stuff, figuring out amortization charts. It's a very nice calculator. It looks really good. However, there is an even more robust calculator, which you don't need for this class, but it's like this. This is the HP12C. Now, the HP12C is just absolutely awesome, but it uses a kind of algebra called reverse Polish notation, RPN. Instead of 2 plus 3, you put 2 enter 3 plus. But its finance power is amazing. Now, this is the kind of calculator. Suppose that you go into a finance singles bar. You sit down at this at the counter, and there's obviously this finance chick beside you. So you put this out on the counter. HP12C, you will breed that night. What was the name of that calculator again? It's a good calculator, but I mean, it's way overpowered for this course. And I mean, even if you're going into finance, which you should because it's a really great field, it's like overpowering unless you're going to do some really, really heavy-duty kind of stuff. TI-83 plus 84, that's fine for this course, and it'll get you through everything that you need. And I never did get that. That thing is just projecting right into the ceiling there. It is not going to come down no matter what I do. I wonder if I just shut down the whole system and let me try something here. Oh, there we go. I just lost my own screen on the computer. Nope, that didn't do it either. That sucker is just not going to come down for me. Should have asked about it. Okay, anyway. Let's see if there's anything else. Again, though, you can pick up the lectures from the podcast if you miss a lecture. And if you're going to miss class, you need to let me know about it, preferably in advance that you're going to not be able to be in the lecture, attend a lecture. My office hours are Monday and Wednesday, noon to 12:30, and then from 2 until class time here, and then by appointment if you need to see me at another time. I think that's about all I need to cover with you for the time being. Make sure you come to class with your calculator, and you'll eventually need a ruler in this class too, because there's a couple of different things we do in this course that are somewhat graphically oriented, and it has to be precise. You have to do precise graphs to catch the nuances and get the right answer. So make sure that you have some kind of a ruler or a straight edge as well, for as well as your calculator and your note-taking abilities. Let me get started here with a few minor points that are absolutely important, crucial for you to understand finance before we go any further. By the way, I also, over the years, I started teaching 32 years ago. Over the years, I've taught math and a number of other subjects, including English and grammar and court reporting and things like that, and economics. And I'm going to fill in some blanks. I'm sure most of you have taken economics already. You didn't take it from me, so you didn't get the quality that I can give you, and I'm going to have to fill in a few blanks in that. And a few of those I'll do today, and then later I'll do a few other pointers on economics as well. And then later on, further beyond that, we'll also get into some other subject matter that you've already been exposed to, but I'll have to show you how we think about it in these kinds of classes, in finance classes. But the first thing that I want to get across, as far as finance goes, is that it is a subdiscipline of economics. The book says that it is actually a cross between economics and accounting. That, to put it in technical terms, that's bullshit. It is not accounting. We don't do accounting. Accountants do accounting. They think they do finance. They think that they do God, but they don't. I will disrespect accountants several times in this course. I promise. Not as much as I'll disrespect marketing, but... No, that's cool. If you want a job selling suits at S&K Men's Warehouse, I'm with you. But... finance is not accounting. In fact, we use accounting data, but I'm going to give you some real big cautions on using accounting data, especially anymore. You see, the reality of it is that accounting numbers don't include what we value most in numerical quantitative information in finance. Even worse than that, darker than that, is that now the lid has been blown off the fact that the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve, and the Securities and Exchange Commission were allowing too-big-to-fail companies to lie on their accounting financial statements. Lie! So the basic numbers that we are supposed to use in finance to analyze companies were bull. It caused the wreckage of really good investment analysts, brokers, their families who invested with them, and outside investors who invested with them. Tens of thousands of people got burned because they believed the numbers that were being presented as audited financial statements, when in fact, those were not correct. They were absolute lies. Back in 2007, the banks, the very largest banks, were beginning to come apart at the seams. And the Federal Reserve began a program of funneling insanely large amounts of money into these banks secretly. The banks were not disclosing what came to be in a couple of years, over a period of a couple of years, $7.7 trillion. The banks were reporting it. So, of course, obviously, analysts like me would have said, well, these banks are going to fail. They're dying. And yet they kept going. So the investment advice that we gave turned out to be completely wrong because we didn't know that this insane amount of money was being funneled into the banks and the banks were keeping it a secret. And they were even the SEC was publishing their financial disclosures based upon lies. It was all hidden. And so we had this disaster. It was only after a court ordered the Federal Reserve and the banks to fess up, and they fought it. They fought it tooth and nail, that we found out, so that's why these banks didn't die. At this point in time, now the program is public, it's still going on, you're talking maybe $14 trillion, that's more than the gross domestic product of the entire United States in a year. But at least we know it's happening now. So where do you trust the financial statements that are being pumped out now?
It's a more difficult game than it used to be.
And you have to do more thinking, more gut kind of, what does this look like? And why is the stock performing this way when it looks like the company should be dying? Or why is the company dying when the financials look okay? You have to begin to think a lot deeper now than we did back in the day. I ran a penny brokerage house back in the early 90s. It fell apart really quickly because of regulations that shut me down, but it was all a lot easier back then. Take all that aside. What the accountants do is important work, and they have to follow important fundamental rules, especially about reporting costs. They have to be able to say, here is a receipt, here is a documentation for a cost that we have had. In finance, that's not really going to matter a whole lot. Documented historical costs are really not too exciting to us. The most important cost that we don't see in financial statements that is crucial and driving in the business world itself, in which I participate as a professional. I have a company, it's called Emergent Light Studio, professional landscape photography. I have to consider costs that don't show up on financial statements. There's no place I can put them, there's no place I'm allowed to put them. The most important of those costs is opportunity cost, the cost of the best foregone alternative. Opportunity cost, the cost of the best foregone alternative. In other words, you, sir, you've got a job. You can make $10, $7 for you, $7 an hour. You see. So when you're not at work, okay, we'll give you 10. We feel sorry for you. You know, we don't want you to get food stamps. $10 an hour. So when you're not at work, that's a cost to you. Every hour that you don't work is, oh, well, I've got to sleep. Well, there's no question about it. You got to sleep. You got to take a crap. You got to try to breathe. I don't know. You got to find, you know, you've got a game or whatever it is you do. You got to eat. Yeah, so you have to do those, but the reality is that even though you have to do those, you're not being paid for that time, so that is a hidden cost. Direct cost is what comes out of your pocket. Opportunity cost is what does not go into your pocket, and it drives business decision making. It really does. You finish here at Illinois State University. And you come to my office right when you're graduating. We've arranged, we've worked hard with you, and you got a job at State Barn. $60,000 a year. And so you leave that last day, and I'm so proud of you. God, look at him. He's wearing a suit, and I mean, he actually has some sense of fashion after all these years. Don't see you for a couple of years. Then in February, 2 years later, you come to my office. Professor C. Well, I'll be darned. Look at you. You look good. Yeah, I came to your office to tell you how my life is going. Well, you've been at State Barn like a couple of years now, so, you know, you should have gotten a couple of promotions. I am so proud of you. Well, no, Professor C. I walked out of your office and I realized I don't want to do that. Wait, what? I wanted to live my dream. The hell was your dream? I wanted to run a donut shop. Wait, what? Yeah, I wanted to come to you because I just got my first full year's financial statements back from my accountant, and I made a profit of $20,000. Aren't you proud of me, Professor C? You know what I'm going to say to you? You dumbass. I want you to go and burn that donut shop to the ground. Oh, bring me the donuts first, for God's sake. Let's not get radical here. And you're saying, what? I made a profit.
You lost $40,000, knucklehead. How did I lose? Because you could have had $60,000 and instead you gave that up for $20,000. That's not good. The opportunity cost of what you did, of making $20,000, was $60,000. So in economic terms, you lost $40,000. That means you suck. You understand this? In finance, yeah, what you bring in is great. We need to know that, but we also need to know what you didn't do that you could have done instead. Opportunity cost drives decision making. Because most of the time, your opportunity cost is a lot larger than your direct cost. You'd be surprised. Think about what you're doing here. You're sitting in these classrooms. That almost brought up that tumor in my lung. Yeah, no, it's back down there. We're good. Okay, you see, look at what you're doing here. You're sitting in classes. $10 an hour you could probably pull. Maybe even more if you got a good body like you, son. You know, for the ladies, you know, obviously. Mr. January, yeah. Okay, look, you could do other things, but instead you're here. You're going to classes. You're studying. You're going home and getting tweaked. You're doing a lot of things that you... No, let me see your teeth. Yeah. Do you like sex? Bro, man card issued. You could be making $10 an hour. Well, I want to make $10. This might be the only chance of my life. Yeah. Doesn't matter. You are wasting money. You see, and this goes for businesses. You wouldn't believe the number of times as a consultant. Well, we got this project. You know, we're going to get a positive net present value. Where's the land price? Well, we own the land, so we don't have to include that. The hell you don't! You could sell that land, or you could use that for another project. That most certainly is a cost of this project. When you reassign a current employee to a new project, that is a cost of that. Well, we're already paying him. No, but you're not paying him to do this. He could be doing something else. Opportunity cost drives decision making. Now, you can go to different grocery stores here in this good town. You can go to Walmart. Low prices. Well, you can even go to Aldi's, but I hate Aldi's. They make you pay for your damn cart, a quarter. And they throw your food on the floor. Walmart, low prices. But you could also go to a pricier store, like the store called Schnucks here in town. Now, Schnucks has higher prices, but it's the same stuff you can get at Walmart. Why would anyone go to Schnucks when Walmart has lower prices? Well, that's kind of obvious. Let's talk about going to Walmart. The first thing you have to do is find a parking space. So you drive out to another county and park, and then you try to walk your way back in. In the parking lot, you almost get hit by these big-ass trucks. A bumper sticker says, "My wife, yes, my dog, maybe, my gun, never." And then you get in the store, the first thing you say, "Hi!" And you look around, oh God, they're hiring midgets as greeters now. And then you walk down the aisle, there is this fat cow. "Honey, what do you want for dinner?" "Did I get out of the way, cow?" You search, you have to use Google Maps to find the damn food. And when you're done with that, you go up the line, sure enough, a conga line, 5 miles long, and right in front of you is a cart full of kids, and some snot-nosed kid with his finger up his nose is staring at you. "Get away from me, you weirdo." And then up at the front of the line, Granny is using a debit card for the first time. Oh, that was... I did it 12 times, I don't know what's wrong. "Hurry up, you old bat, you're gonna die soon. Go home and eat." 30 minutes. Just frustration. You got a schnucks, there's hardly anyone there but yuppies. I mean, there, you know, these people look down their nose at you. And that's cool, because you go through the line, you just, it's a smaller store, you put your hands on the merchandise, you go up, there's hardly ever a line, you just check out and you're gone. You understand that if you are making $40 an hour, and you're making $10 an hour, 30 more minutes at Walmart, for you, $40 an hour, you've given up $20, you've given up $5 at $10 an hour. So clearly, you are going to be willing to pay as much as $15 more for a shopping cart full of groceries. You see, that's how we use prices to control who buys our products. I'm a business person. I sell online, but I also, my bread and butter is selling at arts festivals. I price high because I don't want riffraff in my display areas. I want the people who can afford high prices, because otherwise I've got all of the Ma and Pa Kettle and all their kids coming around. Oh, look, that one's $12. Oh, that'd look good right next to the Velvet Elvis painting. God almighty, no. $200, that keeps them out. That's how we do it, with prices we control. And that goes back to the basic economics of opportunity costs, you see. Another thing. At the top of this building, there's actually a way you can open up this hatch and get up on the roof. Woman, I will give you $1 to get up on the hatch and jump off. What the heck? We're all going to be up there. Go, go, go. You'll be on YouTube. No. You'll be famous. No. $2. No. The hell? You know? I offer you good money. I mean, money, more is preferred to less. Here's more. These are good. I mean, yeah, I kind of did a stinky fart, but, you know, they were in the side, you know, so they're cool. You know what? You are risk averse. You're afraid of risk, like everyone else. You see, if I offered you $1 million, you might do it. You actually might. Figure, you know, I'll break a few bones, someone will have to find my spleen downrange, but at the same time, yeah, maybe. You see, here's the deal. We expect a return if we are going to bear risk. And the more risk we have to bear, the greater the return we expect. You understand that is a fundamental principle of not just finance, but of life itself. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. And make note in your notes, expected. The future is not certain, but we are definitely not going to bear a great risk for little in expected return. You see, that's what is motivating you. You don't want to take a risk for a lousy $2. 20?
No.
Fine, we'll work on it. But you see, that's a driving principle. So you see, we've got a company. It posts a profit for the quarter, and the stock price goes to hell. What are they doing? Why did it go down? Why did investors sell off? Because for the risk that they were bearing in that stock, in that investment, the expected return did not materialize. So they punished the ass of that stock. You see, that's how life itself is going to work. If you're going to take more risk, you're going to have to expect a higher return. And it's going to be based upon a combination of your experience with this kind of situation, but it's also going to be based upon your basic wisdom, understanding, all of that stuff, information you have. Like I said, these are expectations. These are not realities. Now, here's another one.
I'm laying out costs for you, you see. And the relationship between returns, return and risk and expectations and all that. Here's a cost. I see someone who looks like an astute investor. You're wearing glasses. You must be a smart person. So let me talk to you. Madam, you have invested, 1 year ago, you invested $100 in a stock. And the stock price is now $10. In other words, you invested in Facebook. No. $10. The stock price dropped. And I say, well, what are you going to do? And you answer me, well, I'm going to hold on to the investment until I'm going to hold on to the stock until I recover my investment. What's wrong with that plan? Do you see anything wrong with it? Again, she bought it for 100, it's at 10, and she has told me, her investment advisor, that the stock, that she's going to hold the investment until she recovers back to $100. It recovers back to $100. Is there anything wrong with that plan? You're shaking your head no. Well, let me ask you, where is that $100 now? Say what?
Gone.
It's with Jesus. It died and it went to heaven and it's sitting at the right hand of the Lord. And you ain't going to get it because Jesus saves. I owed you on that. You are set up so good for that. I'm going to hell. Okay. You see, that $100 is gone. You aren't going to get that back. I might have been your broker. I've already turned that into a meal. You see, your future, your decision now has to be based on future expectations. Sunk cost doesn't matter. Sunk cost fallacy is thinking that it does matter. You would not believe the number of companies. Well, we got phase two of this project. It's going to be $5 million. Well, is it a go? Well, we've already put $7 million into it. So, yeah, that's the stupidest ass thing you could ever think in a business. That $7 million is gone. The question is, what will be the ROI, return on investment, of $5 million? The $7 million is gone. You're not going to get that back. Salvage value of the project if you decide to abandon, that's not related to how much you paid. That $7 million is gone forever. Look forward in time. Don't try to cry over spilled milk. It's not worth it because it's gone. And it's really hard to think about that. But it really is the way it has to be if you are going to be an efficient investor, an efficient financial analyst. The past is over with. There was a Stephen King novel some years ago called The Langoliers. Did any of you ever read that or see the movie? It was about these things that ate the past, and these people got sort of stuck in time, and they were not going forward very fast, and the Langoliers were catching up with them and consuming it. That's the way we have to think in business. The Langoliers are right behind us. It's not what you did for me yesterday. It's what you're going to do for me tomorrow. That's all that matters in business. Now, in your lives, maybe you want to think differently, but you're going to find out that the more you live, the more you find out that it's very much that way. What's your expectation for the future? Not what has happened in the past. And in your life, you are going to find that that is very much the case. Let me give you an example of this. You have had 20 years of blissful marriage. It's been unbelievably good. You and your wife, there's just that wife, right? Woman.
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make sure. We're good. I got to be sensitive now. It's been great. You know, you have fun together. You come home every night, and she's got your favorite music, your song. As a couple, you are so beautiful to me. And you think about that song all the time, and you're so happy. So one night, out of nowhere, after 20 years, to come home. And it's dark in the hallway. There's no sound. Honey, I'm home. Suddenly, Honey comes out from the side wearing a Nazi uniform with leather and a submachine gun and fires 20 shots at you. Brrr. You dive out the door, you fall backwards, and you run to your car as you hear her screaming, "Die, butthead!" And you pull out of your driveway and you screech away, totally confused. What the hell is happening here? And it's night. And it's raining. And God Almighty on the radio, sure enough, the song is, "You are so beautiful to me. Can't you see?" Tears are pouring down your eyes. Now, are you going to go back to your place and say, "Hi, honey, I'm home"?
No.
What the hell? 20 years?
I'm going to get shot.
Well, I mean, it was 20 rounds. I mean, that's one a year. You know, come on, man. Ah, you see, you're thinking right. It's not the average. It's the marginal, the last, that matters in business and in your life. You're going to see that more and more. So when you think about those 20 beautiful years, they ain't meaning shit. Because right now, you've got someone who wants to kill your ass, okay? And that's what's going to drive your decision making. That, and not history. Historical doesn't matter. Now let's go to another example here of this. Madam, you graduate from here. You're going to get a great job in Chicago, and then you realize that's not what I want to do. I want to own a gas station. Just one of those little gas stations, you know. So you buy a little kiosk gas station, independent, and you buy yourself a little black and white TV to sit in there. You change your name to Ed so you can wear a shirt that says Ed. Now, you're the first, all along there are gas stations, your row, but you're always the first to get the gas from the Cocaline truck, $3 a gallon, 20,000 gallons, and you mark it up 25 cents to $3.25, prevailing, okay? Well, right after you say goodbye to the Cocaline man, he's giving you a lollipop, he's a really great guy, you know, $3 a gallon for 20,000 gallons, you post your sign, $3.25. And then you go back in and you're about to sit down, watch your little black and white TV. You got the news on. Well, it's Fox News. But on the TV, you see a mushroom cloud. And then it switches to these tanks rolling across sand. And then it shows this ungodly picture of a massive ship sinking. Israel bombs Iran. Iran responds, 3 silkworm missiles into the Gulf sink a supertanker. A sunburn missile has reportedly hit an American aircraft carrier and it is now sinking. Response from Iran also includes what apparently is a launch of a nuclear weapon against Tel Aviv. The Persian Gulf is in flames. The Strait of Hormuz is now mined and blocked. By the time that Cocaline driver gets to the next station, it's $10 a gallon he's selling it at. So sure enough, all the way down the line, there all of your competitors are posting $10.25. What are you going to do?
I'm going to raise mine, but not as much as $10.25.
Why not?
Well, I guess I could because I'm the first mathematician.
Look, I want you to be a bastard.
Okay, raise it to the same amount as this.
That's right. You see, because what's going to happen when Cocaline comes back around and sells you the gas at $10 or $11 or $12, and you don't raise it as hard as you can, you don't have it. But my customers love me. Isn't this? That would be unethical. I can't be charging them. They ripped me. That'd be a ripoff. My customers love me. Well, you know what they're going to do if you don't charge the prevailing? They're going to wipe out your gas, and then they're not going to remember one thing about you when your shutters are closed because they'll just drive right down the road. Customers are as loyal as we are.
and we ain't loyal to anything but our profit. Okay? You see, here's the issue. Replacement cost matters. Historical cost is irrelevant. You see, the market bears a price. That's not really related to cost. We hope to God that we can command a price above cost. But this idea of cost plus pricing, that's ridiculous. You charge what the market bears. And you better be able to charge more than the cost to replace your current inventory. Otherwise, you're out of business and your customers don't care. They'll just drive right down the road to the next place that has the same product you had. That's how nasty it is. But historical cost cannot drive decision making. Only replacement cost. So you see what I am doing here, what I am striving to do here, is to start to turn the common thinking that you would have out there into the precise thinking that is required to be a business person. Because when you say cost to the average person, well, that just means what I paid for it. And in business, that's just the beginning of the cost, the opportunity cost, the replacement cost, trying to fight the urge to go historical cost. And there's why accounting kills us. Because by necessity, by the rules of accounting, they have to report only direct cost, and what they report is historical cost. And what matters to us in finance is something quite a bit different from that. We need expected cost forward, and we need replacement cost. And that means that we have to look into the future. And unfortunately, the future has this really bad thing about it. We can't see it. So we have to have tools, the best we can do, so that we have some sense of what in the world is going on out there. In the world of your lives, as your financial lives, you will be both a borrower and a lender. Now, we use fancy terminology, surplus economic units and deficit economic units. A surplus economic unit is something. It could be an individual or a group or a bank or a trust fund or even a country that has more funds than it currently needs. And then a deficit economic unit is something like a person, an individual, or a group, or a nation, or a company that has a need for funds currently. So you could be both a surplus economic unit and a deficit economic unit at the same time. Like, for example, you could have $20 to lend a friend right now, but you don't have the money for your tuition, so you have to borrow on a student loan. In your life, you'll be saving for retirement, like you'll be able to save enough to eat something other than cat food. But I don't mean to discourage you. But you'll be saving, so that means that you'll be part of a pool that is a surplus economic unit investing. But you're also going to be a deficit economic unit. You'll need to buy a house. Okay? So you can be both at the same time. But here are the driving forces. Well, first of all, we use the term financial intermediation as a catch-all for matching surplus and deficit economic units. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. It can be done by a lot of different things. Do not say to me on an essay question on an exam that it is financial institutions that do this. They are one player, but there are a lot of different ways that financial intermediation can happen. There are a lot of things that are not technically banks or savings and loans or whatever, or even formal in a sense. Financial intermediation happens in all kinds of ways. We just kind of think about it with financial institutions. But it's not just the matching. The financial intermediation has to take into account three fundamental factors. First is the level, the amount. In other words, you might be a surplus economic unit, you might be a deficit economic unit. He's got $20, you need $100, so there's no match. So there's no financial intermediation. Okay? So it has to be, the levels have to be the same. You might be a multi-billionaire. He needs $100. You don't have time for that nonsense. Okay? So level or amount. Now the second one is timing. The match won't happen unless the surplus and deficit economic unit have the same timing in mind. Well, I want to pay him back in a month. I want my money back in 3 days. The timing wouldn't be right. So, and we see this is a hugely important thing in investment, because that's why we have all kinds of different financial instruments. One of the reasons is that we create financial instruments for different clientels of timing. What was I thinking here? So for example, a lot of times, you know, your fundamental investors that are flush with money, they might want to invest for, say, 20 years. They won't need the money back for 20 years, and so they will put it into some kind of an intermediation setup so that they are matched with 20-year borrowers. Corporations often, and governments often, issue 20-year instruments. Others, they would like their money back in a day. We can put them into all kinds of things, money markets, sweeps, things like that. Some investors want theirs back in a year. Well, what, or 30 days. If it's 30 days, we got something called commercial paper. I'll bring that up later. But there are a lot of different things. We even have investors that don't want their money back for 60, 80, 100 years. What kind of an investor wouldn't want the money back for 60 years? Anyone know? Okay. How about life insurance companies? I'm going to tell you something kind of really that you might want to know. You're going to die someday. It will probably hurt like hell. You'll bitch and you'll scream, I don't want to die. I see the devil. But you'll die, and thank God, because we were getting sick of you bitching. But that will probably, actuarially speaking, that's not going to happen for about 30 years. 60 years. So obviously, in a life insurance company that is amassing money from the premiums wants to invest that in such a way that the probability of having to pay out would be somewhat closely matched with the probability of having to pay out, you see. So there you go. In fact, there are some instruments now that are hundreds of years long, borrowing for 200 years. What could possibly be a kind of company that would want to invest and not want to see the money back for over 100 years? Anyone know a company like that? Commercial property companies. When you insure, do any of you know what the New Madrid fault line is? You ever heard of it? There's a big, huge-ass fault line, ancient, that's underneath here. It has very rarely gone off. The last time it went, it tore, was in the early 1800s. I've read the stories, letters written by the people of the time, describing, it was like they were describing something out of an apocalypse. Literally, they were describing how the Mississippi River flowed backwards. It didn't flow backwards. The heave of the earthquake threw the water of the Mississippi back north, and then when it got up north, it all came back down like a flood. mean, it was just unbelievable how horrible it was. But the New Madrid is one of those nasty, weird little fault lines that busts only every couple of centuries, five centuries, whatever. It certainly doesn't go off very often. And so, if you are going to insure against earthquakes here, you would collect insurance premiums, but you wouldn't expect a massive payout for hundreds of years. So there you go. And that gets us to the difference between frequency and severity. Think about the 9/11 attacks in September 11th of 2001. When the towers, the World Trade Center, the Twin Towers were insured, there was only one of them insured. Because the probability of a whole skyscraper falling is almost ludicrously small. Of course, obviously, the probability that two would fall at the same time, that was just impossible. Well, they both did, and only one was insured. There you go. But anyway, let that be a lesson to you. If it sounds like it'll never happen, don't bet on it. It probably will. Level, timing. And there's one other factor that is involved in financial intermediation. In other words, the matching process must take into account level and timing. And there's one more. Risk. You see, some people... Have you ever known anybody who was just an absolute crazy mofo? I mean, no, I'm serious. You know, mentally insane. I met a couple in the Army. They were bad enough. But then after that, I met this rich kid who liked to outrun Florida State Highway Patrolman in his BMW. God! Never changed my diaper so many times in my life. You see, most people like to think, well, I'm really crazy, wild and crazy. Truth of the matter is most people are pretty risk averse. And the more they know, the more risk averse they are. That's why young people seem to be stupid. It's not that they're really, they are. It's not really that they're stupid as much as it is that they just don't have as much experience that would inform them of the total globe of risks involved. But the truth of the matter is most people are pretty risk averse, but they fall into different categories. Some people are willing to throw the dice. Other people, they do not want to take a chance. So when we give investment opportunities, when we match surplus economic units and deficit economic units, we need to make sure that we have appropriate investments. So now, I'm looking for someone who meets my criteria. Well, you all meet my criteria. Right now, sir, you are young, and you could throw money into an investment. And if you lost that money, you would have a long time you could recover from it. And that's something important to do, is to know your limits young so that when you get older, you know what your limits are. But someday, madam, you are going to be old. You're going to be decrepit. You should really start using oil of Olay now. Okay. And when you are old, you don't want your money being invested wildly. You want safe investments that will give you a pretty much guaranteed return. Because when you're old, you don't have time to recover, and your stomach really isn't made for eating cheap cat food. So when you're young, you will tend to be willing to invest in higher risk instruments. And as you are older, you will tend to pull back your horns and look more and more for safer investments, which tends to mean that you would see more equity investment in younger people, more bond investment for older people, just because bonds are safer and they just pump out that coupon every 3 months, 6 months. And so when we look at this matching in financial intermediation, risk is very important to the equation. And remember this, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return, though. So what happens in finance is that we have to do a balancing act. You have to say, all right, you want a high expect, you expect a high return? Well, you're going to have to take some really serious risk to do that. Oh, you don't want to take that kind of risk? Well, you're not going to get a higher expected return. So here's a lesson for you in this. Have any of you ever heard of Bernie Madoff? Scammer extraordinaire, built a pyramid scheme. You had to be an insider, a friend of a friend. Only the rich people knew about Bernie, and you had to get on his good side, or you couldn't get in on these incredible deals he had with insanely high returns. Year over year, insanely high returns. But boy, once you got in there, once you were on Bernie's good side, after he'd abused you and suspected you, you were in on it. And you made returns on your investments that the little people couldn't possibly dream of. And then finally, the whole pyramid scheme crashed. And all of these people lost all of their money. And they screamed for Bernie's head. Hang that man. Damn him. Look what he did to us people. How dare him? We will get restitution. We'll send him to prison. We'll demand that we get our money back. Whatever. But you see, in finance, there's no crocodile tears for those people. They were getting returns that were insane. What did they think? They were better than everyone else? Well, you'll get if you're lucky on a CD, you'll get 0.5%. Well, they were getting 20%, 30%. Was it because they were special? No, they were not. They just thought they were. They were still subject to the basic principle of finance. The greater the return you expect, the greater the risk you must bear. And if you are going to bear risk, you are going to find out one thing is rather bad about risk. When you jump off that building, woman, and you hit pay dirt, you're going to die. But here's the upside. We'll put it on YouTube and it will go viral. Guaranteed. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.